All right, good evening, everybody. It's the Conway and Whitman Show on 97.1 FM Talk Station. Tim Conway Jr. and Brian Whitman. Nice to see you, dude.
How are you, Tim?
I'm doing excellent, man, especially with our guest in studio here. I listen to this chap every night during the John and Jeff commercials. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Drew Pinsky's with
Very
us.
Kind.
Nice to
what a
see
nice,
you, man.
Kind intro. I appreciate that. Thanks, Tim. Well, congratulations on your new digs here. This is great.
Yeah, it's
Everyone
beautiful,
seems, like,
huh?
Elated and upbeat.
Yeah.
And, I hear Corolla complain about the old station still. You know what
right,
I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, that's how much of a vet. Although, I got to tell you, these headphones.
They're terrible.
It kind of reminds me of the old
oh,
station.
Yeah.
Well, at least I get the feel of having been at that station.
Yeah, and if you smell them, you'll also get the smell of
oh,
the old
I
station.
Smell them. They're on my ears, but
yeah.
I smell them. Don't worry.
Nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Dr. Drew is an addiction medicine specialist. Is that correct?
Right. And I've been doing this show called Loveline for many, many years.
How many years?
23. And
23 years you've been over there, huh?
84. No, 21. 21
Jesus
years. 22,
Christ.
Probably. I remember New Year's Eve 1984 at the old K-Rock Studios in Pasadena.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my that gosh.
That
is wild.
Wow.
Oh,
yes.
How many co-hosts have you gone through?
Three regular ones. There was a lot of intermediate people. But, you know, the movie I would like to see made is about K-Rock in the early 80s. The characters that I witnessed while I was in medical school broadcasting late at night there was unbelievable. That was a piece of radio history. That
a lot of cocaine
never,
and
he,
chicks.
He basically either treated everybody or they're dead. That's basically what's
oh,
there.
Oh, is that right?
So, yeah. But a very colorful. No, it's not that bad. But very delightful and colorful and really colorful.
You should pitch that as a movie. I guess you can't
I keep
now.
Thinking about it. It's sort of time for the next incarnation of American Graffiti, isn't it? For the new
It'd be generation. Perfect.
That's right.
Right. It's the old K-Rock guys, and then they're all on a couch, and you're trying to help them all.
That's right. So it was. Oof, yeah.
They all die on you.
And so anyway, the reason I bring that up, that's that show up, is that as a result of doing that for many years, people have always made me the sex guy. Even though
right.
that was never really my intention, that the show has been about. Really, I always thought about as youth health. And if you're 20 years old, you don't have prostate cancer and schistosomiasis. You have reproductive problems. You have emotional problems. You have drug
right.
and alcohol problems. And focused a lot of my training into areas that was pertinent to that area.
Good but, for you.
But also addiction. Obviously, there is, Dr. Drew, sexual addiction.
Oh, we can talk. Well, Brian, we'll talk. But anyway, yes, that's a huge and difficult problem to treat. We can go into it. But the bottom line is, as a result of all the sex stuff, and even though I'm an addictionologist, Discovery Health came to me and said they want to do a sex show called Strictly Sex.
Is addictionologist a sex doctor?
No, although we deal with 85% of drug addicts have to have some component of sexual compulsion or sexual addiction.
Now, how do you yeah. take somebody who is addicted to sex and cure them? I mean, with drugs, you just take them off drugs. Do you take all the porno out
well,
of the house?
It's like eating disorders, right? You can't not eat, but you have to have a period of abstinence and then go about it with a sort of a structured and sort of a balanced way.
Is it tough to cure?
It's very tough to cure.
Is it tougher to cure than heroin?
Well, it's a lot of the same stuff as heroin. Here's sort of the recipe for sexual addiction. Childhood sexual abuse, family history of alcoholism, you inherit the gene. Usually you get into some other chemical first, and that sort of turns on the drive systems,
right.
and then off you go into the sexual
Wow, promotions. Then I'm a sex addict.
Congratulations.
I was expecting that. You got new partners, one too.
Yeah,
it's fantastic.
Everybody around here.
Dr. Drew, I don't know if this is a silly question, but is sexual addiction actually maybe healthier than chemical addiction if you got
to
pick one?
Everyone loves to think that if there's one addiction they'd like to have, it's that one. But if you've never met more wretched, miserable people than sex addicts, and they first of all they're sexual abuse survivors, you know, essentially without exception. So they have
right.
very very deep trauma issues. They have profound sense of shame about themselves in terms of what they've been doing with their sexuality, and that shame fuels more compulsion. Tim, you right. seem like you really relate to this.
He's leaning in. You see him leaning in?
Right, yeah, got it.
I'm actually
yeah.
watching,
so then what do I do?
I'm actually watching ESPN while Dr. Drew's talking. But yeah, no, I understand that sexual addiction, they say that especially if you have something for children, that you can never cure that.
Right.
That's incurable.
Well, it's treatable. But the Delamo Treatment Center here in Torrance mm-hmm. is one of the world centers for this. A guy named John Seeley over there, a friend of mine, does outstanding work, and his constant mantra, his refrain is, please come to us before you hurt somebody.
Right.
Because this is you can't contain these impulses, and they will get higher levels of arousal, more intense and bizarre kinds of things become necessary to get the same arousing experience. And if you've had sexual abuse in childhood, about a 60% chance you're going to go down that path.
Yeah, there's a big debate on a lot of the cable news stations now. I mean, we've seen some articles in the newspaper about this civil confinement issue where you take someone who's a sex addict, who's a sex offender, who's a violent sex offender, and the idea, Dr. Drew, is to, after they get out of prison, to put them in some sort of confinement, almost like a mental facility, so that they can't act on their...
Yeah, why not? It helps them. Listen, did you see the blogs or the email stuff that the... He posted stuff. The guy that killed somebody a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I read that the other day. Yeah,
where he was desperate for help. He wanted containment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hey, doesn't mean they can't have sex.
But aren't all bloggers like that?
Oh, I'm sure. But anyway, so no, I you mean they all need containment? They're crying
out
for
help. They all write stuff that is is wildly unbelievable.
Well, that's not inconsistent with how I've seen these people think.
Right.
People with those disorders.
But you know what do they give? Is it methadone they give to drug addicts?
I'm not a huge methadone. I'm not a huge replacement fan.
Right.
They were finally going after drive modulation. The ways of addiction is of any type is a disorder of the fundamental motivational systems of the brain. What allows us to set motivational priorities minute to minute gets broken. And all the drives get focused on the drugs or the behaviors, whatever it might be.
The instant gratification.
It's not the gratification so much as the survival system becomes focused on these drugs rather than survival itself. So it distorts everything. And things that should have a higher priority suddenly go way behind.
I see.
So what we try to do is change that biology back. And that's actually happening. There's a medicine called Campral out there we use now that's a GABA A receptor agonist and whatnot. It's used to modulate a part of the brain called the amygdala. And lo and behold, I've had some fantastic results with that for alcoholics.
Right,
where it decreases their drive to use. It's not like Anabuse, where you're gonna vomit if you use. And guess what? If you want to use, you don't take your Anabuse. You go use. This is a drug that actually decreases your desire
now,
to use.
Does Anabuse come on? You can order it on the rocks.
Yeah, I'm sure you've had it that way, but I mean,
you get an umbrella in it,
a little
twisty straw.
No, it's actually a sword, a plastic sword with a little cavalier hand.
Dr. Drew is with us. Dr. Drew Pinsky. He hosts Loveline. He also has a TV show. Another venture in TV
strictly,
for you.
It's actually a good show. Strictly Sex with Dr. Drew. It's on Discovery Health Channel. Wednesday nights and Saturday nights, basically 9 and midnight. I don't know how much longer than 9 p.m. will be aired, but midnight Wednesdays is sort of the target night.
On what channel?
Discovery Health Channel.
Discovery Health Channel. I got
to
get that.
In addition to the radio and the TV, forgive me if this is a question I should know the answer to, do you see patients as well?
So he does all day. In the morning? You up at 5, 6 in the morning?
No, my life is pretty balanced right now because I have lots of outstanding partners that allow me to sort of move flexibly into the things I want to do day to day. Tomorrow is going to be a little rough, but I run the chemical dependency program over at Los Encinas Hospital in Pasadena.
Right.
And I have a small medical practice I work in, and so there you go. That keeps me busy.
Seeing any new patients?
No. Well, at Los Encinas, I'll see new inpatients, but I don't see new outpatients. I closed that a long time ago.
All right. Dr. Drew is with us. If you have a question about your drug addiction, perhaps sex addiction, from what we understand, the demographics of this station is 98% of you out there are addicted to something. So call us here at the radio station.
That'll be America.
Yeah.
That's the host or the listeners?
Everybody. Everybody's a mess. 520-9710. That's 520-9710. Hey, and Sprint PCS #971.
Sidebar. Tim and I had Tim and I have had like a dance for a couple of years. I finally broke through. He finally likes me.
Not true, dude. I liked you from the get-go, man.
Somebody speaking?
Yeah,
I was like the man when I got here. Tim was like the man. I think you finally realized that. No, I'm just
get out of here. Just saying this. No, I've always liked Dr. Drew. I took my wife, your last book, with the Humpty Dumpty book.
Yes, thank you. Cracked.
And she read the entire thing. I brought it home at midnight, and she read till 6, 7 o'clock in the morning. Read the whole thing that night.
That's very unpleased.
And just, she loves you, man.
Well,
I tell you,
you're
like the perfect guy to her.
Here's the problem. This is what my wife complains about. I'm out doing stuff like working at the hospital, but I'm writing about it as opposed to home. So you get the lonely complaints, and
I'm sure you go home every night. Sit at the edge of the bed, put your head in your hands, and just go, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. And she's staring at you, smoking a cigarette. Does that happen?
No, because it's midnight when I come home. She's asleep.
it would seem that you're very vulnerable, Dr. Drew, to the charge of, as Tim suggests, maybe the perfect guy, and you're giving this advice, and you're a very healthy person.
Oh, no, I get from my wife you're always fixing everybody else's problems. Why don't you work on ours?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What is she doing? Her Megilla Gorilla impersonation when she yells at you?
No. She's actually, well, that was that sound like Megilla Gorilla?
It's pretty good.
I get it all night from him. I mean, it's just, it's an endless cycle.
By the way, very timely reference. I'm sure three of your listeners know what you're talking about.
I have the same thing to say about the impersonation, too. All right. So, Dr. Drew, I got a couple of questions for you. Since you are a doctor, I've got, these are not sex addiction or alcohol-related questions, but I hope you can answer them.
Yes, good.
One, if you hold, if you constantly hold your farts in, what kind of
effect?
I
knew this would be a highbrow discussion when I got here.
Would it take 8 minutes and 41 seconds to get there?
I know of no major untoward effect of holding your gas.
Good. Okay. So when people say, I couldn't hold it in, that's BS.
Yeah. They may have sort of, well, there's no, they can actually mechanically not be able to, because as you age, as you gentlemen know, your those muscles become what we call patulous. Things aren't as able to
I'm there. Now, so what happens? Where does the gas go? I mean, you hold it in.
Oh, it just percolates. Yeah, it sits. To come back, it's going to be some absorption. It's basically the stuff that smells is methane produced by split by the bacteria in your bowel and your colon.
Oh, I see. That's why milk makes you all crazy, huh?
Well, for some people, that's why some people don't have much smell, because they don't, the bacterial mix isn't there to create that.
Oh, that's pretty cool. All right, so no bacteria, no smell.
Well, certain bacteria.
Wasn't that Rick Dees's rule?
No body function was his rule.
Please, anything but body function humor. I'm begging him. Just no body function. Anything but body function. I mean, vomiting, belching, all of it.
I got another question for you, and then we'll take some calls here. I go into the men's room here at the radio station, and it's a disaster. It's a disaster.
It's every night with
it. It smells like hell. It smells
Brian?
Like
No, it's not. Use a public restroom.
Brian will not use a public restroom. His OCD. He could be at Los Encinos tonight with OCD.
That's tough. Yeah.
So so I go in there. It smells like hell. Now I take my T-shirt and I put it over my nose.
Shields up. Yeah.
Is that a placebo or is there some kind of actual effect in filtering of fart?
You probably feel. Well, first of all, you just have air just what's under your shirt, but then against your skin.
So you pull your shirt up over your nose.
There's probably a little something to that.
But basically, just smelling himself.
Yeah, you're smelling yourself.
But you're not really filtering any of the.
I don't think you're really filtering anything
of the fart, right?
No, I don't think so. No.
Last question.
Another fart question?
Yes. Is fart...
Glad you came in tonight, Dr.
Drew.
Oh,
man, am I.
Is fart, like, atomized duty? I mean...
No, it's some of the same... What gives the duty the smell is, again, the methane created by the bacteria. It's all outside your body. See, people have this very bizarre concept that, ooh, I got to take colonics and I have things going on in my colon. I need to cleanse it out. Your colon's outside your body. The colon has one function. That is to absorb water. So that's what makes it go from what it looks like in the small intestine to what it looks like when it comes out. It absorbs the water. And there's tons of bacteria that live in there and kind of push things along and make sure it all stays outside your body, because that's a closed anaerobic space with stuff. And the bacteria grow and live in a nice, happy medium there. But none of that's in your body.
All right.
It's all outside.
I asked the questions that nobody else. Everybody's thinking.
From stem to stern is outside your body.
Forgive me. I didn't think I'd get in on this conversation, but actually I'm compelled to jump into the fray. So the high colonics, the enemas, overrated, Dr. Drew?
That's overrated. Bizarre concept if you really understand. For instance, when you did have a colonoscopy, something we should all do every 5 years, it can prevent colon cancer. It's something we all need to do after the age of 50.
At 50, okay.
And if you have strong family history of colon cancer, maybe start around 35. Katie
Holmes?
Today Show.
Katie Couric.
Katie Couric is very, very hot on this right now. And when we do this, we give you some things you drink that completely cleanses your colon, so there's nothing in there, so we can see every molecule of the lining of the colon. That doesn't do anything for people. Why aren't they just doing that? That's more cleansed than a high colonic.
Yeah, why don't they do that?
Yeah, because... Doesn't do anything. It just cleans
you
out.
Like a barium enema?
No. We take stuff from above, so every speck is out when we go up there with the scope and look around. Oof. So there's nothing there. There's nothing there. And guess what? There's never anything like mucus or shunts or these bizarre concepts people have. There's just colon lining you're looking at there, and you can make it sparkling clean with something from above.
Can you buy that over the counter?
The point is that people have this people have this concept of, ooh, if I put something in and hose it out, I'm cleansing it.
Look at Insulaco. First guest we've ever had, he's taking notes in there.
I know, look at that.
All right, so from your mouth to your bum, that's all outside your body.
Outside your body.
That's interesting. I never thought about that. So that whole system, man, is perfect.
It's just a tube.
So if you take...
It's a big, long tube.
What is the actual substance you take that cleans out your body?
We used to have something called... it used to be called Go Lightly. It's a great euphemism. Go like hell. And then it became... Then they wisely changed...
Go Like Hell would sell more than Go Lightly.
They changed the name to Colite. And you drink like 4 liters of this stuff. Right. And you'd be you'd be washing. Now they've changed and made it a little more clement. There's basically some phosphor sodas and things like that.
And that works better than any kind of enema.
Yeah, because we have to be able to see every millimeter of your colon. We go in there with the scope.
And how long will that keep you clean? I mean, you know, once you have your first burger, you're euchred?
Oh, yeah, by the afternoon, you'll be back. And Tim, but, you know, I'm just saying. You, who knows?
All right. And by the way, Dr. Drew has a theory, and I subscribe to this as well, because he does, and I think he's a smart dude, that once a guy turns 85, your body just turns to hell.
Wow, you really cling to some of the things I leave behind.
Oh, yeah.
Is that what I said after? You don't want to be a male after 90. I was sort of, I guess, going off about how people want to live to 120.
Yeah.
That means you've never seen a 95-year-old male. Right.
Try it sometime.
Yeah, they're wretched creatures. You're miserable at 95 as a male, particularly. Women
is
sometimes
there pain,
okay.
Or is it just?
It's pain. You can't pee. It hurts when you pee. You can't poo. You can't move around. You just are. They're just depressed and just miserable.
So you suggest like an 80-year-old sex change?
No, I'm just. Well, that'd be nice. But I'm just because you know.
Would
you
some got, of the pain go away if you had a sex change?
No, it's probably more the genetics. Yeah. We're just genetically inferior. And
so
women live longer.
Dr. Drew, you would then support like physician-assisted suicide?
Oh, now you're talking about something totally different. But I'm just saying that all this stuff about lived to 120 is overrated.
But say you get to 95 and you're just going, as you say, I can't pee, I don't want to.
Let me just, it's funny you would bring this up. I don't have a strong opinion about it, but I was thinking about a friend of mine's dad who was a very well-known internist in town here who got colon cancer. By the time they picked it up, it was systemic. It was, you know, metastatic. And he picked a day, went home, took care of his business, finished everything up, and then took something. That was it. And
Is that right?
And I thought, that's what doctors would do for themselves most of the time.
What a way to go.
And he was able as a physician to get his hands on what he needed to do.
He felt okay back, and he knew the handwriting was on the wall. He didn't want to go through the misery and the horrible destructiveness.
Did he do anything fun at the end, like bet a wild trifecta that he knew couldn't come in?
Probably, I don't know. But the point is, you know, people that actually deal with these conditions are generally in favor of assisted kinds of things.
And how was his
comfort and dignity and palliative care? You know, there are limits to what the body can do.
How was your friend his son with his dad's decision to do that?
I haven't really talked to him about it. I don't know. He's also a physician now, and he probably feels
he's on heroin now.
No, he's probably
Drew's pretty, treating him.
Probably feels good about it
because he knows too that was, you know, it's a rational thing.
All right, Dr. Drew Pinsky is with us, and we will take a ton of your phone calls. If you are you got addicted to something, I know it's not your fault, but call us here, and Dr. Drew will give you the short answer and cure you over the phone. Is that what you do?
Well, maybe not a short answer.
All right, gang, Dr. Drew Pinsky is with us. It's the Conway Whitman Show, Tim Conway Jr. and Brian Whitman live on 97.1, the FM Talk Station. It is the Conway Whitman Show. Tim Conway Jr. and Brian Whitman on 97.1 FM Talk Station. Dr. Drew Pinsky is with us. A quick question before we take some calls here. What is the best antidepressant on the market today?
It depends on what your needs are, what the circumstances are. It's the thing. This is why the whole Tom Cruise thing to me was so ridiculous. He's talking about depression as though it's one condition with one treatment. It's a complex set of conditions with different biologies, different psychologies, and different interventions.
So you don't agree with Tom Cruise?
I don't agree with Tom Cruise.
Are you questioning the credentials of Dr. Cruise?
I think he got bashed. I think he really got nailed and almost unfairly.
He got hit pretty hard.
It was nice to sort of bring up a question of do we overuse pills. I'm all for having that discussion. But he unfortunately couched it in sort of an epistemological tone.
What about a good sleeping pill? What do you recommend?
Again,
Lunesta is
there? Lunesta is a new one. There's another new one coming out that's supposed to be a next generation Ambien, which is probably the best one out there. But they're all addictive. All addictive.
Wait, Lunesta, I've heard, was not addictive.
All addictive.
I don't like
it. There will never be a non-addictive opiate or a non-addictive hypnotic or a non-addictive benzodiazepine. Never.
But because I take Ambien.
They're fine if you don't have the gene for addiction and if you're using them on a limited basis, they're excellent medicines. Excellent.
But is it more that some of them can be psychologically addictive?
I'm glad you brought that up. Addiction is a disease of the drive centers of the brain. There's no psychological component to it. You either can stop or you can't. And when you can't, we know it's because of these drive abnormalities, these disturbances of motivational priorities that are biologically based. And once they're in place, you can't stop. If you don't have the genetic predisposition for that, you ain't going to get that. Now, you can get dependency. Like, let's say you took Ambien every night for 3 weeks. When we stopped suddenly, you could have a seizure, you could withdraw, and then you'd leave it behind and you'd never think about it again. If you're an addict, you'd be preoccupying about it, you'd be thinking about it, you'd find your way back to that or something else because that system has now been activated.
A seizure? People, you stop taking, you have a seizure?
Absolutely.
Is that one of the side effects?
Well, it's potential if you're using large doses regularly, sure. I mean, the benzo withdrawal, the short-acting high-intensity benzos.
Why are you snickering and looking at me, Tim? Excuse me, Dr. Drew, for just a moment.
I was thinking that...
Why the laughing and, and the glaring?
If you can have a seizure once you stop Ambien, I think they should list that as a side effect.
Oh, I'm sure it's in there.
But the seizure puts you asleep, wouldn't it?
Yeah, be asleep afterwards.
Is there such thing as a good seizure?
Not that I can think of.
Like relaxing?
I'm sure... No, I'm not... Well,
pleasant seizure?
I don't think I think of.
All right. Dr. Drew is with us. Dr. Drew Pinsky. Let's take some calls here. Julie in Torrance. You're on 97.1. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
All right.
Is this Dr. Drew?
Yep.
Okay. I have a quick question for you. I used to be a drug addict, and I was addicted to a drug for ADD called Dexedrine.
That's just speed. Plain old speed.
Oh, definitely. And I was addicted to it for 10 years. And I actually went through a program called Narcan.
Oh, that's...
And I don't really believe in the Scientology part.
That's Scientology.
Yeah, but I don't, like, believe in that part. But the program that I do believe that really got rid of the cravings is all the niacin they give you. And they give you this stuff that's the CalMag that flushes all of your system out. And they put you in a sauna and you sit in there
just
for,
the
like...
ADD kicking in.
Well, those are bizarre interventions given what we know about the biology of these things. I mean, if I put you in a cell, your cravings would go away too. And you know,
really?
Yeah, amphetamine cravings go away.
Wait, so if you just lock somebody in a cell, eventually all of their cravings go away.
The cravings can become cue driven later, but the heavy, desperate cravings go dramatically better, if not away completely. Depends on how long you're abstinent and what kind of drugs you're using. But cravings, don't mistake craving for drive. Drive to use sets the motivational tone of the brain and is often non-conscious.
Right.
It's your brain going, move in this direction, make these choices, and eventually find your way back to the drug and alcohol. That's different than I'm thinking about the drug, preoccupied about it. Cravings are actually kind of good because it lets you know your disease is active. It motivates people to stay with their treatment. But it's different. That's a different biological phenomenon than drive abnormality.
All right. Dr. Drew Pinsky is with us. And first of all, you ever smoke pot? You ever smoke weed?
Very little back in college when somebody said to you,
Did you enjoy it?
No, I didn't. Thank God. Because marijuana is an interesting drug. Marijuana is relatively benign in occasional use. It can addict certain people very rapidly. And again, you have to have a genetic predisposition for this, and it usually requires some priming effect. Like you have to use it two or three times. Then the third time, ask somebody who smokes pot ask somebody who smokes pot every day.
Yeah, let's ask Malibu.
And they will tell you that the third exposure, it's like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever done.
Wait, this is the third exposure experience. In their life or third exposure of the day?
In their life to pot. So there's a sequential priming effect of the drug.
Really?
And then it's pow. Then you're just thinking about that
Did
all
you ever
the time.
Get there?
No. In fact, I had friends that said that was my problem. I didn't do that.
Oh, you didn't do that?
Thankfully, I never. Another thing, I clearly don't have that gene. I've had a hernia operation and I was given Vicodin after the procedure. And I hated how I felt on that.
Did you feel depressed?
Awful. Just worse.
Angry?
It's like, no, just awful. Is it worse? Mm-hmm. So awful that I let the pain run and run and run until I started having like suicidal thoughts.
Oh,
like,
Jesus.
Oh I got to take this. Thank you. Yeah, and that's nutty too, right?
Yeah.
But the point is that see how different that biology is. And somebody who takes Vicodin, it's like all of a sudden everything in life is okay. It feels
Vicodin's
great.
Vicodin's great. It's the best.
Yeah, people feel great on that. Mm-hmm.
We're generally fans.
I am being Vicodin. I'll keep a list of your current meds. Anyway.
I'll tell you what the nicest buzz on the planet is to be in Las Vegas in front of a slot machine, two Vicodins and two shots of vodka.
Well, here's a Vicodin card. Get Mike.
Let me ask you real quickly.
Let's talk about a real Vicodin.
But what about Vicodin? How do you get off of Vicodin?
That's what Mike wants to ask.
Which
line three there?
Let's talk to Mike in Long Beach. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was curious. I had a surgery, and then a doctor gave me Vicodin, and then
it led on and on
like almost 5 years now.
Yeah.
And it's like now I'm preoccupied with finding more before I run out.
Right.
You know,
how many? What are you using? How many a day?
I only use about four a day or five a day, which is a lot less than some people I know that are doing 20. But
you're fine.
My average patient does 30 to 50.
Wow,
and I've had a guy doing 100 a day.
Dr. Drew,
Mike, how do you get the medicine?
I get it from a doctor, and then I also get it from the street.
Internet, street, they go to multiple doctors, they know what to say. It's a survival thing. They have to survive. They feel like they got to have it. It's a preoccupation. They plan for it. They do it.
Wow.
The guy was taking it. People know about Vicodin. It can cause deafness. With the House Ear Institute here in Los Angeles, they actually documented that. And this guy that was doing 100 a day came in with just stone deafness, just completely deaf, spontaneously. Pow, woke up one morning, that was the end of that. The 50-a-day user is 30 to 50-a-day user, sort of my average patient. And it's interesting. I was in a court case once where a doctor got up there and went, that would kill somebody. It's impossible. You can't take that much acetaminophen or Tylenol because Vicodin is Tylenol plus opiate plus hydrocodone. And the fact is something about the way people use Vicodin or escalate their use of Vicodin allows the liver to compensate for all that Tylenol load such that it's able to metabolize it into a non-toxic byproduct.
Liver's a smart organ.
It is.
The liver enjoys the buzz too.
I've treated probably 2,000 or 3,000 Vicodin addicts, and I've seen one have a liver problem.
Are you kidding? Mm-hmm. Is that right?
I have to ask a question about the constipation with you.
Yeah.
You know, you have the, you know, I had wisdom teeth. A one tooth removal was 3 weeks ago,
right.
And I had Percocet, and I mean that's mm-hmm. a problem. You know, you
it's
can't really
one.
Go.
Yeah.
So if you're
did you crush up and shoot intravenously? I mean, you guys are you're going in that direction here, guys.
I had a tooth removed.
You were total lunatics.
I got a prescription. I mean,
yeah,
you
know, yeah.
If you had a wisdom.
No, it'll make
tooth,
you constipated. So these guys deal with that by taking things to compensate for it. They'll take laxatives regularly instead.
And now the question that I'm sure Mike had, how do you eventually get off of Vicodin?
Well, I personally, there's a lot of controversy about how to deal with opiate addiction, which is what Vicodin and heroin and Percocet and OxyContin, they're all opiates and they're all basically the same thing as far as your brain is concerned. There's methadone, which is a replacement therapy, which means you're going to be on something long-acting that diminishes some of the behaviors around addiction, but means you're going to be ill the rest of your life. You're sleepy, you're tired, you can't concentrate. Let's put it this way. We don't give methadone to doctors, airline pilots, or attorneys when they want to get off Vicodin. We don't do that. So my point is it's not good enough for us, but it's good enough for your patients. I don't know about that.
Yeah, but the difference is the guy who's the pilot is in charge of 295 people. The guy who's riding his bike around with a 12-pack of Budweiser in his sister's basket, that guy can be on methadone.
Point taken. That's why that option is out. There's also something new called buprenorphine or Suboxone that unfortunately is also highly addictive drug, and I end up taking people off that all the time now. It's something, again, another replacement therapy for people that have AIDS or who are unmanageable or just have life-threatening opiate addiction. These things make sense, but for the average person like Mike, first of all, you can't detox outside a hospital. It never, ever works. Although Suboxone has been advocated for that, I've just never seen it really work. That somebody stays off Vicodin.
So
you have to go
inpatient.
into a program. You got to set aside about 6 weeks.
Bubba, who's
the withdrawal
got the
is only a week. The withdrawal is not bad. And standard therapies make the withdrawal really easy.
And then you sit in a group of losers in a circle talking about how your parents beat the hell out of you.
That's some of the talk that goes on. But really, the treatment process is about rewiring the regulatory systems in the brain. And that's using intersubjective experiences with other people.
Yeah, but
primarily one person.
The so-called group of losers that Tim referred to a moment ago that's hit in the circle, Dr. Drew, that is really a fundamentally important part of that.
Yes,
for
Tim this is a stretch, but other people are important. Yes, other humans have an importance to us.
Right,
yes, they do.
All right. But I can't imagine sitting there. Everybody, you know, all the guys have plaid shirts on, you know, plaid flannels, the ripped jeans. The chicks have tie-dyed shirts on. Their hair hasn't been washed. They have thongs on.
No.
And they're going to tell you how, you know, stupid their lives are, how
got a
stupid
lot of,
yours is.
I treat a lot of doctors, a lot of lawyers, a lot of airline pilots, a lot of celebrities. And I treat some 18-year-olds. I treat some 75-year-olds.
Now, let's say you go in for a Vicodin addiction, right?
Yeah.
And you're an inpatient. Do you guys frown on making calls to your bookie while you're in for Vicodin?
And that's interesting you would bring that up, because what happens when you come off the opiates is your brain is so used to using that same system in order to regulate unpleasant feelings. It's using to seek things outside of the self, outside of the body boundaries in order to regulate unpleasantness. The behaviors that will do that suddenly emerge. So it becomes sex and shopping and gambling and dramatic relationships and thrill. All kinds of thrill become extremely appealing.
You can't
and do so,
that.
Yes, you will see people start to steal and do all kinds of crazy stuff. It's like steal hats at Saks.
Is that right?
That kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
That's a typical behavior of my patient.
A caller said that he takes 4 or 5 Vicodin a day. You said you treated a man with took 100. The average is 30 to 50.
Yeah.
So the obvious question becomes, what is too much?
I mean, when are you addicted?
Right.
When you're preoccupied, when you have addiction is defined by consequences. When you can, you know, when you're it's progression in spite of consequences. Health, relationships, work or school, finance or legal. If you're not having consequences and you're using your Ambien, you seem to be fine. Whatever.
Let me real quick before we get a commercial break. When's the last time you think that I've taken a Vicodin?
8:33.
Clock. When's the last time you think I took a Vicodin?
6:30.
6:30? That is wrong, sir. June 10th.
Uh-huh.
No, I had an operation on my nose, and they took out polyps out of my sinus cavity, and they gave me 40 Vicodin for the week.
Oof.
And I still have, like, you know, zero left.
You're not a Vicodin. Yeah. Oh, well.
No, I took, but Dr. Drew, I took 40 in about 2 weeks.
Don't you guys always say you need to finish your prescriptions?
Oh, yes.
Yes, of course.
You betcha.
And don't stop them unless we instruct you specifically.
All right, Dr. Drew Pinsky is with us here, 520-9710, Sprint PCS, #971. It's the Conway and Whitman Show, Tim Conway Jr. and the addicted Brian Whitman on 97.1, they're from Talk Station.